This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
How's it going, guys? Yo, when we got up here, we were doing a thing called sound check, and we found out that, well, Jimmy Dorn was all excited about Eddie Vedder and him jumping around up here.
Right there. He jumped right off of there.
Oh, right there.
Yeah.
But more important than that is Houdini. Houdini was on this stage.
He was right about here.
Right here.
Two times. My brother always likes to talk about how Houdini died, where Houdini felt that, do you guys know this? That he felt that he could, like, clench his stomach and withstand any blow. And some kid was like, well, I'll try it. And fuck, killed him, man. Like, hit him. He did.
Well, we were discussing that. We thought you were part of the conversation, but you obviously weren't listening to us earlier. Yeah. But the stage manager told us that, yes, that happened, but that's not what killed him.
Yeah, it did. It ruptured his appendix.
He tried to do a trick after that in a water tank, right?
Yeah.
He was drowning.
And he
couldn't get through his act. He couldn't get through his act, went back, wouldn't go to the hospital or something like that, and died. It wasn't this stage. We should just act like he died
they
here.
They said they cut out a beam under right. the stage that's still cut from his act in like 1905 or something.
Yeah. Mm. Houdini.
More theater. Oh, my.
Introductions. the Laughing Eagle, Giannis.
Thank you.
And Jimmy Dorn from Belltown Pizza, who's been on the show. If you wanna patronize Belltown Pizza under Jimmy Doran's command, your time. Oh no. Then you have a long time to patronize Jimmy Doran's pizza restaurant.
Hopefully not that much longer.
How many years you been at Belltown Pizza?
16.
16.
I've
years?
Been there 17, but yeah, been running it for owning it for 15, and then hopefully. Winding down.
So I told him he doesn't even, if he doesn't say anything tonight, that's all. I told him he doesn't have to say anything. We just wanted to be represented by a generalist Seattleite outdoorsman.
Yeah, I fit that mold.
This guy, he likes to catch salmon. He likes to shoot at deer. He likes to root. And like every dude I know in Seattle, like every guy in Seattle, he's like, well, yeah, but I liked the Seahawks a long time ago.
I did. I liked the Seahawks when they sucked, but we've been very fortunate. They don't suck anymore.
My favorite story, I think, is the one you tell about Jimmy's turkey hunt, how like overnight he became an expert turkey hunter.
Yeah, because you guys walked up on some turkeys one time?
That's a good story. We were actually driving back from a set in the morning where we had sat out and froze our asses off and didn't see a thing. And we were 2 weeks into the turkey season, and I believe the guide took us to a place where everything had been shot. And our guide we were just literally driving back. And he's like, hey, I just want to check this little sliver of public. And we were just taking a meandering route through this one little sliver around the Colville area. And we came around a corner, and there was literally 8 toms in the road. And we basically jumped out of the truck and shot them.
And we got a text, and he's like,
yeah.
What's so hard about this?
Yeah.
It always happens that way.
I didn't really call it a hunt. I called it more of a shooting thing. A get. A get's a good way.
And then our very own Sam Lundgren. Sam writes about all kinds of stuff for us. What's that?
Your people are up top.
I don't know. There's some Whidbey Island in the house?
Those guys don't matter. Oh yeah, tell where you're from.
Yeah, I'd like to consider myself a generalist Seattleite hunter, although
yeah,
I'm
not
now a card-carrying Montanan.
You quit and moved.
Yeah, quit and move. But I did grow up on Whidbey Island. I lived in Washington until I was 22.
And then April Volkey, who's not only not... She's not even from the damn country. What's the town? Yeah, I know. Like, tell where you're from, and then how you always apologize about it.
Oh, yeah, but I always say don't tell anybody.
Yeah, no, that's right. She's
sorry.
Sorry, what? Don't tell anybody.
That's
don't
right.
Tell
it's,
anybody.
It's, yeah, not the yeah. It's Surrey and don't tell anyone. So now you've told everyone, and everyone knows. A couple of y'all I want to say hi to. So happy anniversary. We have Ross and Megan Sharp. You guys here? All right. There's a bunch of guests. There's a bunch of people you would know from the show. Tommy Edson's here. He's been on that show. Tony Caligrossi's been on the show.
Tony.
Greg Blaskovich has been on the show.
Greg.
I think my friend Bowman's here. I never let him come on. and then down from Joint Base, Lewis McCord, we have Seth Wheeler, who I met earlier. So him and his teammate are here. Good dudes. Been in and out of war zones for a long time now, as we were just discussing. And then I used to kind of be, I was like a temporary Seattleite. And I got all nostalgic here because we rented a, it's an Airbnb, but it's more like a hotel, I feel like.
It's like an apartment building,
yeah,
I guess.
We rented like an apartment.
High-rise apartment.
Which looks down on my main, most important squid jigging spot. And I got super nostalgic about that. Man, I didn't realize how much I was going to miss it. I moved in August, and I got to thinking about razor clams, jigging squid. And the thing I like most, and this is why I don't trust anyone in this audience, is because when I lived here, I discovered that you guys are sitting on the continent's greatest yellow perch fishery. Now, don't do that. Don't do that, because I'm telling you, me and my little boy hit it hard, and we never once saw a serious perch fisherman on that lake. And you know the lake I'm talking about. It's a big-ass lake, and as you catch fish, cyclones of perch come up with the one you're reeling in. It's unbelievable. And people don't, because you guys are steelhead and salmon snobs. I had to like defend myself constantly as a perch fisherman from Michigan. But
we had to bring
out
in a guy from Oregon with a boat so that we could get out there and fish together for those perch.
Our buddy had to drive up with a boat from Portland to take us perch fishing one time. And that guy, he ate his first ever smallmouth bass out of Lake Washington.
Oh, wait, you went out in that bass boat? The sparkly one?
Oh, you remember the sparkly bass boat? Yeah, we fished perch out of that.
Okay.
That was Matt Elliott's special bass boat. He came out to fish bass, but I've filled his little live well up with perch.
Well, they haven't opened the sockeye season for such a damn long time that maybe people should just get into perch instead.
Well, yeah, when was the last time did that
2006,
happen?
I believe.
So there's no sockeye fishery?
No, they haven't come back in the numbers.
Open season since 2006.
Yeah, the last time it was open, my dad and I ran our boat down from Whidbey through the locks, through Lake Union into Lake Washington, fished sockeye for a couple days, and then went all the way back. It's crazy when that. I hope it happens again someday because it's such a shit show. It's amazing to watch. It looks like you'd walk all the way across the lake from boat to boat, like
it's hard to
canoes
picture,
next to yachts, next to like drift boats.
Are they bottom bouncing for them too?
People are mostly trolling.
Okay.
But I don't know. I imagine you could jig them too.
Because on the Fraser, we used to line up with like bouncing betties and then 20 foot leaders and then go through and floss them.
Right, right. Well, Lake Washington, you know, people always talk about how sockeye don't grab stuff that people are always flossing them, but we'd troll a big flasher with a bare red hook behind it.
Yeah, no, they'll bite.
Yeah,
they'll bite.
Hammer that.
Mm-hmm. Bare red hook, like a
bare red octopus hook, like size 2.
And that's legal in this
snelled
country? You can do that here?
Yeah, you're not snagging, they eat it.
Yeah, no, we weren't allowed because they would eat a bear hook, but it was illegal in BC. So we had to put like a little tuft of green yarn.
You have
yarn.
A lot of dumb laws in BC.
We do. Did you have to pinch your barbs?
There's a lot of dumb laws in Washington too, to play fair.
Yeah, but they got some wicked laws that she was telling us about. That explain about if you're not a resident, you can't.
Yeah, this is recent, but if you're a non-resident of British Columbia, you can't fish on weekends in the Skeena system or on several classified rivers.
Yeah, when I fished the Bulkley, I had to pay $40 a day for Thursday and Friday, and then they kicked me off, and we had to keep on driving.
Yeah, the majority of the residents actually don't support it. It's a long story, and it's very political, but it was the guide movement that pushed that, not us.
The guide, because if you're fishing with a guide, you can fish weekends.
Yeah, and I don't guide anymore, so don't point at me. But
and isn't there, aren't there some streams that are completely closed to like?
Actually, aliens? There are rivers that are BC resident only, so it's not like it's not Telqua? Just Canadian. There are like the Telqua.
Yeah.
But even someone from Alberta can't fish the Telqua. No, you've got to be a BC resident.
Man, can you imagine trying to pass a law like that in the United States?
No, man. Cause we believe in American rights.
Yeah, yeah. tell all these people they can't come fish the Madison.
Sam, while you're, can you break down the thing I told you to break down that's happening here in Washington?
Which thing was that?
You got three things you got to break down. This is the first one about the bill that will never pass, but Washington's backpack tax.
Yeah, okay, cool.
And the proposed exemption.
Yeah. This is something I just read about this week, that there's legislation in the Washington State Legislature that they're proposing to have what's broadly been talked about as the backpack tax in hunting and fishing world, which basically have people who enjoy the benefits of what we as hunters and anglers pay for with our excise taxes through the Pittman-Robertson Act and the Dingell-Johnson Act. So what they're proposing is to have a tax on outdoor equipment over $200. You know, in Washington State.
Well, no, wait.
Two tenths of 1%, but you would be exempted from said tax if you could display a hunting or fishing license. I think it's a damn good idea.
Oh yeah,
I am completely supportive of this.
Because they know that you've already paid 10% tax on a bunch of your equipment, and so now other people are gonna pony up, and it goes into the wildlife fund.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And in Washington, there's a hell of a lot more people who are enjoying looking at wildlife and just enjoying the idea of wildlife. There's a hell of a lot more of them than there are of us.
Now, I haven't seen any polling data, but I'm going to venture to guess that this will not pass.
It's dead on arrival, but it's a good idea.
You know, a thing I wanted to mention, I should have mentioned it. I should have pivoted when you guys were talking about bear hooks. I just wanted to throw this out because we just spent the weekend in St. Martin in the Caribbean for a birthday party. And I flew down with like hooks in a carry-on bag. But down there, you cannot carry on to a plane a fish hook.
And up until very recently in Canada, you couldn't carry on your fishing, like your line?
Line.
And in Australia, still, you cannot carry line on.
Because you're going to garrot someone with
it. I've had to gut reels in airplanes.
But shoestrings, neckties are fine.
Yeah.
That's like with the hook, because these are like small hooks. I was like, the worst you could do is you could get it in someone's clothes. And then they would be like agitated trying to get it out.
Until they crimp the barb.
Yeah, and then they'd find a way to crimp the barb. And then, but everybody lost their Leatherman at TSA check-in, so they wouldn't be able to crimp the barb. And then you'd like take advantage of the confusion and fly the plane somewhere. But I'm like,
I don't know.
If that's the case, you shouldn't be able to bring gum on because that shit's annoying when it gets in your clothes too. So it's like, I couldn't figure out. Another thing I wanted to touch on is, you know how everybody know like I'm sure everyone knows the story of the guy in Colorado not too long ago that strangled the mountain lion. Like that story, and no fault to the guy that did it. Like, he didn't brag it up. But that story has gotten less and less interesting. It's now that it was a three-month-old, emaciated, 24-pound orphan mountain lion kitten. That's, like, the media loved that story.
We think the lion attacked the jogger, or the jogger attacked the lion instead of the other way around, like it's been reported.
It was a kitten. And again, the dude didn't brag it up. I'm not saying he sold it as something it wasn't, but the story has just, and as it's gotten less interesting, there's less reporting on it.
Yeah, I haven't heard a word about it.
Pretty soon, it's going to be that he strangled a therapy dog rescue puppy. And it'll be,
the airport.
That's the only thing left. There's a guy, and I had to coax this out of him. At first, this guy didn't want me to even say what state it happened in. But then he came, he warmed up to me saying what state it happened in. But as you know, Washington did a very naughty thing years ago and made it that you're not allowed to use hounds to pursue mountain lions. But you can still hunt mountain lions. Let's check this out, though. There's a dude in this state, I don't want to say where he is, but he and he's careful to say that he did not pioneer this technique. Where he's been going out, we exchanged some emails. He's been going out and cutting mountain lion tracks in the snow. So he does the same way like a houndsman does, waits till the right amount of snow covers on the ground, and he goes out and cuts a track, and he just follows that track and waits till things look right, and he sits down and uses a predator call. And then he follows the track and uses the predator call, and he just got a nice big time doing that. 160 pounds.
That's awesome.
Dude.
That's awesome.
That's some tricky hunting, man.
Yeah, serious.
That's ballsy. He's
working for it.
What's that?
Working for it.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
I like that guy.
Yeah, we're also working in the difficult system that you get placed in. I remember that happening when they banned hunting with hunt lines with hounds.
So he life gave him lemons, and he made a...
Lemonade
out of it. A hot tip guy wrote in about... This, I might be the only guy that's going to appreciate this. I previewed it with you guys.
Maybe.
You know what? How many people in here run a stand-up freezer instead of a chest? Yeah. It's because it's a smart audience. This guy, you was writing in. You know how you get all your stuff in there and then it all falls out when you open the door? He buys those spring-loaded curtain rods and crams everything in there and then puts a spring-loaded curtain rod in there to hold his... To hold the shit in there so it don't come out.
Prevent the meat Dude. Avalanche.
How does he do it? Does he hold the one arm in and then try to adjust it?
Maybe he has his wife help him out. I don't know what he does.
You know what? He's probably smarter.
But like, some people get all excited about like, you know, the iPhone 10. I hear shit like that and I'm like, man, that's solid. that's a thinker.
That's the real new tech.
Quick thing I wanted to touch on too. A guy I was chatting with recently was... talking about ice fishing, and he had the observation that ice fishing is just a place where people go to do whatever they already normally do well, even better. Where it's like, guys that like to talk, they just talk better and more. Guys that like to drink, they just drink more. People that like to fish more. And that concerns me because that means that my kids are only good at getting wet and cold. Because they do that even more out there. Another thing to touch on, Giannis, we've talked about it. I'm going to put it to bed after this. But if you don't mind, for like the 19th time, breaking down your advice, your marriage advice thing. Because there's two final thoughts I have about it, but I want you to tell everybody, to get everybody up to speed.
I just wish I remember to use it as often as you ask me to tell everybody about the advice. Because now, and I'm like, man, last week, that would have been really good to bring up the 1 to 10 scale game. So I actually stole it from Wayne Dyer, who my dad used to, not really force us, but used to make us listen to Wayne Dyer tapes. Mostly I would just fall asleep, but every now and then you'd pick up something. But he's got a thing where if you're in an argument, most arguments with spouses really aren't that all that important about like who's going to win it or who's going to be right. It's just you really just want to get through it. So his way to do that is to stop, and everybody assigns a value to how important they think the argument is and how important like having it go their way is on a scale of 1 to 10. And so you just stop the argument. And everybody just throws a number out there. And so if it's a really not that important, it's a 2, you throw your 2. And if for the other person, they might throw an 8 or 9, and you just stop. And they get to go on, and you go their direction, right? And it's just an easy way to quit arguing and move on. And you said a lot of times it's worked for you because you realize already, that
we've been
a lot
it's been improving our marriage, man.
Yeah.
I make Giannis, I make you explain this every week. This is the last time you're going to explain it.
Okay.
But there's two thoughts that came in because people have been writing in a lot about marriage. Giannis's, I don't know what you stole from someone, but I'm just going to call it your thing, your marriage saver thing. And one guy is in a, he writes in where he's in a fight with his wife because she likes to put vinegar in the soap in the dishwasher. And he's arguing that if dish soap needed vinegar, they would just put it in there in the factory. So what's weird about it is he's like, but the trick worked because like I actually didn't really care once I thought about it and I threw a 3 and she threw like a 9. So she wins. But then he sits down and writes me a diatribe like this explaining how stupid it is to put vinegar in soap. Another guy wrote in about, he didn't even get into what his fight was, but he gets in a big fight, and he's like, he wants to do Giannis's trick to get out of the fight, and he throws a two. And then gets in trouble for how little he cares. So it's like,
yes.
That would absolutely be the biggest concern, is underestimating somebody else's anger.
Yes.
Right. So, it's like, so if I think if it's a two and you think it's a nine, I might just be digging my hole even deeper.
Yeah, because so, like, why were you fighting about it at that point?
Yeah,
anyway?
It's like, oh, so you don't care, right, about clean dishes. What else we want to talk about? Irrational behaviors. Where
does vinegar in the dishwasher count as that?
No, because I don't really know about that. That might be like a great idea. I don't know.
Here's a hot tip with vinegar. Is I've been frying a lot in the house lately because I got my bitch a new hood over my stove, you know? And I'm always blasting, I'm frying, and it's working, but it's still not like completely diffusing all, you know, grease smell in the house.
I think it's impossible.
It is. But what we do afterwards, or I should say my wife Jennifer does, is I don't know, maybe a cup or two of some vinegar with a splash of lavender oil and just in a pan and throws that on the stovetop and just lets it simmer and kind of disappear. And that just dials the house right back in.
Oh, really? Beautiful.
Yeah. Very nice.
That was a problem
Take
we
that
had.
Home. That'll improve your marriage.
Yeah, because I remember when we used to live in a small apartment, and being from Michigan, I fry a lot of fish. And my wife would be like, how is it that even the bath towels smell like fried fish?
That's the one thing I wouldn't want it to smell like fried fish.
No. When you get out of the shower.
Everything else is fair game, but...
But the irrational behavior there, and I don't mean to be pinned, this is not like a guy, this isn't like, you know, like a guy versus wife deal, but there's a guy wrote in where he was complaining about just coping with irrational things, where he kills a deer, guts it, and then rinses the chest cavity out with, I don't know if it was creek water or creek water, I didn't see the actual body of water, but rinses it out with creek water, and... Now she refuses to eat the deer for fear that it has been contaminated by creek water. And he wanted advice. I have no advice. But in that, like, in that situation, you can only point out other activities, that, like other things that seem irrational that you need to cope with. And I think that the reason this happens so much in outdoor pursuits is because you're just dealing with so many unknowns and untested things, right? It's just in practices to get handed down over time, and things that aren't really, you can't replicate it in the laboratory, like certain odors you might encounter that you could never make. So I think that it breeds uncertainty. So do you guys feel like, have you encountered in your personal lives where you've had to just live with someone else's irrational belief system?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No.
My husband doesn't hunt, and I am obsessed with it. And so we are constantly, we don't see eye to eye on anything with hunting, but in particular, the rangefinder situation. So he thinks that a rangefinder is unethical.
Because it's more ethical to not know how far away it is.
Yeah. So it's a constant battle.
Fling an arrow and guess.
Yeah, he needs to just come with me so he can see what it's all about. But yeah, so I feel like I'm just constantly bashing my head against the wall with some of these theories and opinions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say it's uninformed. But you know, we are going to later give away, we're going to play a game, we're going to give away a range finding binocular. So that was a good tip.
Nice.
That was a good, well, I segued off there if you'll notice.
I like it.
Sam, like, irrational?
I didn't come up with anything for this.
Because you're not...
I'm a highly rational person.
No, but I mean, you'd never... you're still available.
Ladies. Right. Sure.
The segue.
Not married.
Correct.
Yeah.
You never had a relationship that an argument came up
So it's not that I didn't come up with anything for this. I didn't come up with anything that I could say publicly to our audience of hundreds of thousands of listeners. There's nothing. It's a weird gray area. What we're talking about here is a weird gray area of like cute irrational, where there's like crazy irrational that you just don't really want to like air to the public. Like, so
tell me what it is. You don't have to tell who it is.
No.
Do it.
All right. Okay. Are you talking about like an ex-girlfriend?
Yeah.
Okay. And what life category did the irrational thing fall into?
I don't even know which ex-girlfriend we're talking about here.
Let's divide the world into like
rooms of the house. Probably do it that way.
What would be a area of one's existence that the irrational behavior would manifest?
I had an ex-girlfriend who would deep clean her apartment every week. And she would go as far as pulling everything out of her freezer to scrape out the freezer of ice every week.
I would have hung on to her. That sounds like a dream.
There's complicating circumstances. That was not the reason it ended.
I would get her phone number.
He's like, yes, Sunday. Let's organize, baby.
But I'm like, well, you put stuff in the freezer to like, you know, hang on to it, to preserve it, to hang on to it for a while. And like, I'd stacked it full of elk. I'm like, why are you pulling all that out of there? It's defrosting in your fridge or in your sink right now.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's good. I found that to be highly irrational.
That is. Jimmy?
I don't have a lot to add to this. I'm fortunate. Hello.
Oh, come on. He talked me into it. You have to play ball
it's
here.
It's a struggle, though. You know,
I told him I didn't want to talk about this.
I am fortunate enough. My significant other, who is sitting right over there, is very rational, grounded. I find very, very seldom do I find that...
Good call, Jimmy. Good call.
You know, things that'll get me in a twist. I mean, she moves things around. I can't figure out why we're always looking for things that I know right where it's at. But in the grand scheme of things, that is a 1 on the argument scale as opposed to a 10. So, yeah. No, I'm very fortunate. No idiosyncrasies.
You're boring me, man.
It's not boring. It's not boring. It's rational. It's, you know, it's battle. It's not
boring. You just chose well.
I did show, so she chose, yeah, I'm extremely fortunate.
Yeah.
So let me guess, Giannis, nothing.
No, come on. He's going to come up with something.
Like fully irrational behavior by my wife? That's what you're asking me? There's like little things that she does that might bug me, but I wouldn't call it like irrational behavior.
Yeah. Well, I would like...
If she did something like that, where I had done something like rinse a deer out with creek water... And then she was like, I'm not eating that because that water is so much different than stuff that comes out of the faucet. You know, it's rolling down rocks or something and it's dirty. Yeah, I'd stop it at that point and say, we got to have a conversation to see if this thing can keep going on.
We're
going to
cook this meat.
Like in my mind, what I'm talking about would be that one day my wife caught me letting my kids cut up pumpkins with a machete. And she feels that when someone's holding a machete or an axe or something, that it's gonna like inexplicably like fly out of their hand, which I thought was right. But then one day Callahan, who he's holding a cleaver, and she keeps being afraid that it's gonna fly out of Callahan's hand. And so I feel like it's like when she sees a large blade, she feels that it will fly out of the user's hand. And it just strikes me as on par with this. That's all. I'm not sure if he's here or not. There's a guy, he's fishing up Narrows Park, not far from here, on the Gig Harbor side, Narrows Bridge. And he writes in about how everyone around him's catching all kinds of fish. He's not catching one. Is this guy here? Has to do with a diving duck and an eagle? Okay. So he... finally hooks a fish, and he gets all excited for a couple seconds until up pops a diver duck that he has hooked. And as he's reeling it in across the surface, an eagle, I believe him because of the level of detail, eagle comes down and grabs his diver duck off the surface.
We used to have eagles steal our ducks when we were out duck hunting as kids, yeah.
It starts zinging drag out. He... tightens his drag, yanks it, and gets his duck back. It, like, gets it free from the eagle, is able to bring it in, and he's got it superficially hooked, unhooks it, and lets the duck go, and the duck's fine. That's a fishing story.
That is a fishing story.
Another guy...
That's one of those where the duck gets back to the cattails, and he's like, you guys are not going to fucking believe that.
People are like, dude, what have you been doing? He's just like, don't even ask what I've been up
right.
to. That's funny, because like a duck will go through his whole life and nothing really that exciting happens. I remember one time we were up in the mountains and we had hung all of our food up in a tree so bears wouldn't get into it. And then it's like somehow there's like a block of cheese that didn't get hung up in the tree. And so my brother got up and tucked the block of cheese up in a, like on top of a game bag up in a tree. And we come back later and there's a pine squirrel who's discovered the block of cheese, which that son of a bitch has only ever eaten one thing his entire life. And then all of a sudden, he finds a block of cheese, which has to seem like really unusual. And then on top of that, two large bipedal creatures come after it and chase it through the woods. Mm-hmm. And it's like when it rains, it pours, man, you know?
Yeah, right.
Because I'm out here every day, nothing ever happens.
Never seen that one before.
Have you ever, this is super inappropriate, and I apologize to children in the audience, but have you ever seen a duck's penis?
Oh, we were just talking about this yesterday.
They have excitement every day.
Yeah.
That is. They're, if you don't know what I'm talking about, you need to Google this.
Only 3% of bird species have one.
A penis?
Yeah, because they have cloacas. But a duck has, some ducks have one longer than they are.
Do they all have spikes?
Just talked about.
They have like spikes on, no, that's the vagina. Well, yeah, there's
no,
like a.
Spiraled and spiked.
Yeah. So why do they have the spikes? Just to.
I mean, I
so. If that's what you're into.
They don't want their partner to get away, I guess.
There's got to be a biological reason. All right.
No, it's a startling thing, and it's so funny because we discussed this at length last night.
Oh.
Yeah. It's serious business. In keeping with the Pacific Northwest theme, why are you talking to me? Pacific Northwest theme, a guy, I like the way this thing starts. He writes in that his brother... pregnancy checks, so preg checks cows, arm up and you feel around and tell if it's pregnant or not, and he gets paid in salmon. But the salmon he gets have never been gutted. They're frozen gut in salmon, and he wants to know if this is a normal thing or not. I think that is not normal.
Well, is the guy a commercial fisherman or a recreational fisherman? Give them to him.
Commercial.
Yeah, then I'd say that's normal.
No, it's not normal.
When I was commercial fishing, we never gutted a salmon.
You just froze them whole and gave them away to people who preg checked cows.
Yeah, I mean,
we
didn't even...
Uh-huh. Really?
No. I mean, I don't know anybody who preg checks cows, but every salmon we catch in the seine just gets spilled into the fish hole and... freeze to death in 34-degree refrigerated seawater.
So the processor guts it.
Yeah.
So he just skips the processor.
Yeah. I mean, if you're seining correctly, you never touch the fish.
And they freeze guts in.
Yeah.
No one bleeds them.
Obviously, there's a lot of types of commercial fishing, and like we are primarily targeting pinks. So it's like en masse, and then we pull up alongside a tender, usually like Bering Sea crab boats. They take a big crane with a vacuum pump and swing it over, drop it in our hold, and put in a return tube, and just over the course of an hour, just suck all those fish out of there. We have to keep the water level just right, and at the end, I'd have to go down there in hip boots and a shovel and get up in the corners of the fish hold and move all the fish. I often try to like scrape them when they'd get frozen up against like the refrigeration unit. It was really gross. It was my least favorite part of the job. But
are you allowed to take fish home? Do you think he's being lazy, or do you think he's sneaking them out without being allowed to take them?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't know, but I imagine like in Washington, it's either seining or gill netting, in which case you always deliver those fish whole to processors, and you're usually freezing them as soon as you catch them, because you're just catching so many. I mean, like, you know, the biggest day I ever had, we caught 73,000 pounds of salmon
in Pink's.
Pink Salmon in about 2 hours in the morning. And then we were on limits. So it was pretty cool to be like, I just made $3,000. It's not even 10 a.m. yet.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
So this dude will be happy to know.
I got a question, though. Is there, what's the, do you know what the common like end product is for those pinks that you were catching?
I think it's dog food and a lot of like supplements. Canned salmon is a good part of it, the high quality stuff. But I mean, they also fillet some pinks. I wish I knew. I have a lot of friends in that industry, but yeah, I mean, it's not like showing up on fancy restaurants for right. pinks anyway. And where kings typically get caught in trolling, you know, situations or gill netting, where they're, you know, treated with a different level of care. And there's also a big growth in the kind of the it's not farm to table, but it like, you know, boat to table. I actually just had a guy hit us up.
Dudes to do that in Bozeman now, man.
I know a couple of those guys, and this guy just hit me up from Sitka, who it's all about like know your fishermen, and he like they do straight like from the boat. And so those guys are like catching their fish, processing their fish, flash freezing, mailing them off. It sounds like a giant pain in the ass to me, but it's cool to see that kind of thing happen.
Yeah, it's higher because, returns too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like this guy's word choice, because I just realized he describes these fishes whole as hell.
But does it spoil the meat?
Does it matter at the end game?
Yeah, so
like
that's
I know you bleed them and that makes a difference on the quality of the meat, but does it matter? Like if you left the guts in it and freeze it and then defrost it and gut it home, does it matter?
Well, that's what he's trying to figure out, because the dude gave him all these fish.
I wouldn't think the guts would be polluting the meat if it's all frozen.
Yeah, like if it's frozen quick.
I've got two whole lake trout frozen in my freezer right now.
Because they froze on the ice after you caught
them. Because they're frozen the second we pulled them out of the lake. And then I got home and I had to run out here, and I'm like, I don't want to defrost these things so I can gut them so I can freeze them again, because that's going to be even worse on the flesh to freeze and thaw and freeze and thaw. So I did think about this for quite a while, and I was like, you know what, I'm just going to stick them in the freezer. I don't have time.
I've left guts in grouse and aged them for 7 days and then ate them.
Yeah, that's a big thing in Europe, man.
Yeah, well, I tried both. I tried with the gutting, and then as long as it's not a gut shot, I've left the guts in, and I've aged both for 7 days. I mean, it tastes cleaner if the guts have been out, but it wasn't bad. And aged for, like, made all the difference in the world. It was like cutting sushi when I was cutting them up.
Yeah, I would have a harder time with that than fish.
Well, for sure. That's what I'm saying.
Those guts out, those guts reek.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, it's a bad smell.
And grouse are known for having especially weird smelling guts.
They sure do.
I want to get into salmon numbers, because that's like a real a thing that like dominates the conversation around here, and it's confusing as hell. And I'll kind of like lay out, like, I picture if someone from Mars or some outer space planet with just a superficial understanding of the world was listening to the conversation, they would be confused, because you have where king salmon numbers are really low. And so people keep proposing different things that we might do, different things we might try to kill off or reduce in order to up salmon numbers. So it's like, oh, we're going to kill seagulls, sea lions, harbor seals. What else?
Squawfish,
cormorants. But also like name brand sea mammals.
Caspian terns.
Okay. Big list of things. Name brand sea mammals. That you'd reduce numbers to get salmon numbers up. But then there's another name brand sea mammal, killer whale or orca, which is a whole other conversation. Tonight I'm going with killer whale.
Let's stick with it.
So killer whales are suffering from the lack of fish. And no one's proposing, and they eat nothing but kings. And to my knowledge, no one has proposed shooting them things. Now,
not since the 70s.
But everything else is on the list. Meanwhile, and people will be like, okay, another problem with kings, and I'm not a subject matter expert here, this is my observation. Like, another problem that kings have is they're getting too much competition from hatchery fish in the rivers. So that's a concern.
And in the oceans.
But because the one marine mammal is not getting enough fish, They're now talking about putting more hatchery fish in to make sure that that marine mammal, the orca, gets enough, and then we'll get rid of the other ones. Like, is it as confusing as it seems?
Yeah, it is, and it's like right as WDFW is kind of finally coming around the idea that their intensive, crazy hatchery program has not necessarily been the greatest boon to wild salmon and steelhead, especially steelhead. Now the governor's coming in and telling them to start pumping out more hatchery Chinook.
For the whales.
For the whales. Yeah. So it's as complicated as all hell. I mean, I'm even from Mars and I don't even understand it.
It's supposed to be a Band-Aid, not a long-term solution.
Yeah.
Well, that's like it seems. I mean, this is kind of one of the areas where the conversation about salmon gets interesting, and salmon and steelhead, is because you have like it's no secret what the main problem is. The main problem being like a system of dams that blocks fish migration. Like, yeah. It used to take, I think, you know, a fish used to be able to go from its natal stream out to the ocean in 3 days, and now it takes 20-some days in certain river systems. And so it's exposed to so much more predation.
But they're doing badly in rivers that don't have dams, too.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. So it's bad timber practices, it's over-harvest, it's changing ocean condition. There's a lot. Dams being definitely a primary driver.
Yeah, but I find that like some people, like Callahan's this way, or has argued this, where some people are like, if you have this large systemic problem, being like you have this large problem with dams, and they don't want to entertain the micro fixes. They're like, I don't want to condone micro fixes because I want to just focus on what the main problem is. Be like, if you lost your job and had no money, and then you found a dollar on the street, you'd pick it up. But Cal would be like, don't pick it up because you don't have a job. So it's like, I feel the frustration of people who are wanting to, like, we can't control that. Like, that's like a huge long-term problem. But there are small adjustments we could make, and it's like, it makes people extremely upset that you'd entertain the idea of reducing harbor seal populations or reducing sea lion populations in order to try to keep this thing hobbling along while we get up the political and public will to like actually get around to addressing the main problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at it historically, all these things are really closely tied together. In the territorial legislature of Washington, it was illegal to block anadromous fish passage. That was passed in the late 1800s. When they built the dams on the Elwha that were recently removed, they built the lowest dam, which is some 3 miles from tidewater, with no fish ladder, no nothing, just cut it off. One of the greatest Chinook runs ever known. But they made a deal that was later codified in law that they're like, oh, we'll just make a hatchery and solve the problem. We'll just pump out enough fish to make up for the ones we lost. And then that was taken forth into the rest of the Pacific Northwest, that wherever we hose a salmon run, we do mitigation. It's still a word that's just thrown around left and right, but that's where it all derives from. Wherever we ruin a salmon run, we're just going to put in a hatchery and solve the problem. It's going to be all better.
What were you guys saying? Like, what's the typical percentage of with steelhead? What's the percentage of steelhead that are wild-born and hatchery-born?
Man, I was pulling a number out of my ass before, but it's probably less than a quarter anymore that are like native. Like, of all the steelhead that return to freshwater every year in Washington, I bet less than a quarter have an adipose fin.
Here, not in the Skeena. So the Skeena region has the healthiest population of salmon in the world. The Columbia used to have the best steelhead fishery, but yeah, we don't have any of that in the Skeena.
So were you fished steelhead or wild?
Yeah.
Now, because you cut your teeth as a steelhead guide and built your career off being a steelhead guide. If you had to picture a crystal ball, how old's your daughter now? Not
16 months.
16 months. If you had to make a guess, like God's got a gun to your head, and you got to make a guess that when she's your age,
mm-hmm.
and don't play like what you want to happen.
I think about this every day.
When
so hit me with
it. Your age, will she be fishing steelhead? And you have to get it right, or else you die. Like that kind of answer.
So I'm 37. So in 36 years, in the Skeena, I think they'll be here. I don't think they'll be here in the numbers that they are now. I think they'll, I mean, they're the most...
But you think they'll be less?
Yeah, they're the most resilient, I think they're one of the most resilient animals or fish out there. But they'll definitely be here in less numbers. It's really scary.
Have you watched the decline in your own career?
Yeah, yes. And the shifting baseline is really scary. And these people who are fishing, you know, or they've been fishing for 10 years, say, and they're like, oh, well, you know, in my 10 years, there hasn't been a major difference. But they're just, they're not, they don't know what the baseline was 100 years ago. And unfortunately, a lot of people in my age group, they don't want to learn the history, you know, or they don't want to learn about what happened before them. So, yeah, I'm pretty terrified.
Yeah, we had a guy one time describe it. The shifting baseline thing, but he called it shifting baseline syndrome.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that, you would lose your mind.
Yeah, but you know what we're talking about, shifting baseline.
Like your perception of what our perception of like normal constantly, you have to, or else you wouldn't be able to continue being alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know what it's going to be like in 36 years, honestly, Steve. I spoke to a lot of the government biologists, and they've come over. I don't live in Surrey anymore, you guys. I live on the Bulkley up in the Skeena country, and the biologists will come to my place, and we've had, you know, off-the-record chats about the fact that these fish are not going to be here unless we seriously put our foot down. But we have to make some major changes, and I don't think that the sports community or the angling community is ready to make the changes.
What are the changes they don't want to make?
Fishing for them.
I mean, they like to fish for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you quit?
No. I mean, yes and no. Like, I don't want to look like I'm sitting on a throne and be like, oh, yeah, I've stopped fishing for them. Because I think everyone makes this decision in their own time. I personally have cut back immensely. I probably catch 2 steelhead a week, maybe. And if I catch a steelhead a day, I go home. But I also understand I live on the river. I'm out there every single day. I don't expect people to make the same decisions I do. So I'm really close to stopping, especially because the more that I hunt and the more that I spend outdoors, you know, killing animals, the more I start to question my own reasoning for catch and release.
Yeah.
And when you start to question why you catch and release, for me anyway, again, everyone makes this decision at their own time in their life. But for me, it was I catch and release because I'm selfish. And I'm okay being selfish to a degree. I'm a human. I'm an animal. I don't mind being a little selfish, but I have to choose the number on the scale and ask myself, you know, how important it is to me. And when I start feeling like I'm battling or like I'm compromising my integrity,
mm-hmm.
I start to just take a step back, and that's where I'm at now. So I feel like I'm really selfish out there these days.
You know what I had the other day? We were fishing, and we were messing around with some tarpon. And knowing that you're not going to do anything to it if you catch it, mm-hmm. when it came off, I couldn't make myself care.
Yeah, because you weren't going to do anything with it anyway, and you don't want a photo.
I was like, oh, that was cool.
Yeah, see you later.
Yeah.
But when I'm out there...
It was like damn cool to hook into it.
Yeah, but when you're trying to take a fish home...
That was like the accomplishment. And then when it came off, there was no disappointment.
Have you landed a tarpon, though?
No, I've hooked 4 in my life.
I've hooked 1. I really want to hold one.
the first 2 I hooked, I didn't even, they came out of the water and I wasn't even fishing at that point. I was just shocked. And this last one, I like held it together for a couple minutes. But it's impressive. You've caught those probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huntresses.
Just hit me.
Hit me. So you reached out, April, because you want to write a piece about like our use. Like what is
the
a huntress?
Because
why are there no
the
grandmas
huntress?
That are huntresses?
Well, there are actually.
No.
Well, hang on. The grandmas don't have. I'm
they
right in the middle
that.
Of writing this article, so I'm still accumulating my data.
Yeah.
But the word huntress has actually been around for a long, like since 1800s, because by definition, a huntress is simply a female who hunts. But the grandma doesn't have social media, and social media is bastardizing that shit. Like
but
it's really
is
bad.
Neutral.
Yeah, like, lay out your argument.
Well, yeah, my argument...
We're not going around being like, I'm a hunter man.
I don't have an...
yeah, because like,
fisherman is more problematic.
Well, hang on. I don't have an argument because we're on the same...
I don't know. I know you don't have an argument, but I'm dying to get to the part of... I'm dying. Yeah. Just go ahead.
Well, you're putting me on the spot because I haven't actually written the article yet. So I haven't come up with a conclusion.
You can't write it till you think it.
And I think about it all the time. I am by definition, a huntress. I guess, yeah, but I don't call myself a huntress because I don't identify with the modern day use of the word today.
Okay, but here's
because
the question.
Because temptress, seductress, like all these stresses are very sexualized. And
mistress.
And look, mistress. I don't know. It just it just sounds sexy. And I think there was like a comic book series with like Huntress or something like that. And again, I haven't. I'm right in the middle. You just threw me under the bus, by the way. But yeah, I think that Hunter is so gender neutral. And we were talking about this earlier. We're in this fucked up, excuse me, age where there's all of this. Like, I don't even know how to talk politically correct anymore because everybody is offended by something. No, I'm talking now, but like, I just mean, I mean, in general, it's so hard to refer to different people about what they are because you don't even know what people's gender is. So my point is in today's age, we have this word that is so beautifully simple. Right? Like you hunt and you are a hunter. It's not a hunter man or a hunter woman. You are a hunter. Like we have the most perfect package of a word and it's still not good enough. Like I just give up.
Yeah, like when one's working, it's no good. The reason I threw you under the reason I brought this up is someone actually wrote in, I don't know if you saw this, but someone wrote in like, here's a question for April that they wanted to be answered tonight, but it's not this one. But it's one that made me think of this one. Because this person was recently at, what did they put it? They were at an orientation event at a college in Eastern Washington. And it was like the person addressing the crowd was trying to, it seemed to be, I'm paraphrasing, it seemed to be that their tendency was to say, you guys, you guys.
You guys, yeah.
But they had switched to you all. And so the person was wondering, the person's asking you, like, do you take offense by me saying you guys to you?
No.
Because you all is y'all.
It's very Southern.
And that shit is not politically correct. Yeah. I mean, I don't think they came up with y'all.
As like a gender neutral term. Yeah. No, they didn't. Yeah, no, it's not offensive, but I don't know. I honestly can't relate to a lot of the people who are offended by that stuff today. I don't understand the thought process. Have you guys read The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck?
No.
Read it.
Does it get into
it's
this?
It's awesome, yeah.
Do you, does fishermen bother you?
No. No, but I get it. I do get it. Like, I understand if someone wants to call me an angler and that makes everyone more comfortable, that's cool. But again, angler, I'm not going to be like an angstress. What is it? Like a fishtress? If you call me a fishtress, anyone calls
different.
Me a fishtress.
That's something
but
different.
One of the things that I asked all these women, I reached out to 20 different women from spearfishing, hunting, and fishing. All age groups. I interviewed the women who fish in bikinis and, you know, the women who don't even own a bikini. And I asked them, you know, what
they
is...
They just go naked.
That's the new age.
I asked them what the fish version is, and there is no fish version of a huntress. I mean, some angling woman will call themselves a huntress, but... and then I interviewed a 60-year-old female angler. And she says she doesn't like being identified as a fisherman or an angler because she said it made her feel like she didn't have a vagina. So she likes to be called. I know, but I can't relate.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're relating to me.
But she wants to be
you.
A fisherwoman, yeah. And as a 60-year-old woman who is my senior, like I respect her opinion. But no, fisherman doesn't offend me or any of my girlfriends who are really into it.
That's why depending on the audience, like I'll be writing and I'll catch myself to be inclusive. I'll catch myself using hunters and anglers, which is still really clear. Like we're not pioneering new words. We're using words that have an accepted meaning.
Forever.
And it's not clunky. It's not like clunky to say hunters and anglers. And I was doing a story not long ago for Outside Magazine and they were saying, what's a way to say sportsman? And people it's clunky. It's sportsmen and women, which I get the sentiment, but it doesn't reflect a natural way of talking.
Sportsmen sounds like sportsmen to me. I don't know.
Men.
But it's hard because like human, whatever, we're not going to introduce it as like human.
Or mankind.
Mankind.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know how they'd fix that.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Sports people.
Sport? No, it's. I think the accepted one now is sportsmen and women. But a problem, and like everyone's favorite topic is to bitch about PC stuff, which like I understand. But like a problem with it, I think a problem that's coming in culturally with word choice is people are now measuring people. People are now measuring someone's morality, someone's worldview only on the words that like on the use of historic words that come out of their mouth, and not anything about like what the overall content, like what they're trying to say doesn't matter. The sum package of what you're saying doesn't matter. It's just they're like listening for the wrong little thing that comes out of your mouth to condemn that rather than like the gist of what you're getting at.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that like that's the thing that winds up making me uneasy about this. But I do now, I just say hunters and anglers because I like in my heart there's like an inclusivity, but then at the same time, I don't like things that sound weird.
Whoever said it had to be gender specific? I mean, that was the when I call somebody a fisherman, that means that guy's a fisherman. That guy knows what time it is. That or that woman's a hunter. Like she knows what she's doing. It's like it's a term of like it's sugar. I lost my train of thought.
I hear you, man. And to me, it's like unnecessarily divisive.
Yeah.
It's like I'm stoked that hunters are, or female hunters are the largest, like, grow, like, there's more, the more growth in that than any other demographic within hunting in the last recent decades. That's awesome. I'm glad to see that.
Mm-hmm. But
then why do you want to be doing something different? Like, why do you want to go out, like, huntressing? Why can't you just come hunting with the rest of us?
Yeah.
It's like, it feels like it's drawing lines when they're like trying to become, like if women are trying to get in, trying to become part of the community, like join the community, like be part of the club, don't like have your own thing.
It's, but the battle you'll get is the woman, and then we'll drop it, but the battle you'll get is the women I'm hearing from who enjoy the word huntress are badass, organic. You'd never know that they called themselves huntresses, but they've identified with that word for 40 years. Because the word has been around for a long time, so it's hard to strip that from them.
I get it, and I know badass female hunters who love that word. I know this girl who hunts with a longbow and kills deer and elk every year, and I heard her read a poem about how her huntress heart and stuff. But every time she says it, I just cringe a little bit. I'm like, I just don't really that word. Like,
I'd prefer it if
I don't know. I could be convinced otherwise. I'm excited to read the story.
I'm excited to write the story. So I'll keep you guys posted.
She's got to write it before you read it. But I feel like now you got a lot of material.
I already had a lot of material before you threw me under the bus.
I want to get into this thing that's come up in New York. It's the Assembly Bill. It's got an exciting name, AOO722, which does this. It's interesting. It provides that it shall be unlawful. So this is in the state of New York, far away, but it's still our, continent and everything. It should be unlawful for any person to organize, sponsor, conduct, promote, or participate in any contest, competition, tournament, or derby where the objective of such contest or competition is to take wildlife. So it would be illegal to have a salmon derby. Illegal to have
a perch derby.
A squirrel hunting tournament.
What about all these people competing for follows on Instagram? Is that technically illegal?
Yeah. Abel brought good the point that it would kill social media, right?
Well, what I brought up is my dad and I always used to play a game, first, biggest, most.
Not anymore.
Dollar a category. And I loved that when I was a kid. It like, made me work harder when we were out fishing. And
well, charitable fundraisers?
Trading $3 between a dad and his son?
Yeah. And then, but like all the charitable fundraisers that are run as derbies. But I know what they're gunning for. It's a sloppily written law. What they're gunning for is like, the current, like the enemy du jour, which is like coyote hunt, contests. And then there, I think also like shark tournaments.
Well, there's legislation in New Mexico right now that's more narrowly tailored than that, that's specifically going after coyote hunts, I believe.
But in New York, they're just like...
all of it.
Two dudes, I bet you I catch a bigger perch. No, you don't.
Nope.
It's a bummer.
Well, that whole squirrel hunt debacle in New Jersey, did you see this piece that Spencer Newharth? Yeah, you guys already talked about that.
Yep. Yeah.
That was wild. Like seeing the news coverage of that and seeing all the signs that people had, like, lining the road. Because there was, like, four times as many protesters as there were people doing. It was, like, a kid's family thing, like, get everybody out hunting and stuff. And there was some vicious shit about hunters that, like, hard even to repeat.
When, years ago, like, the first assignment I did for Outside when I began writing for them years ago was to cover a shark tournament in New York called Mako Madness. And I interviewed a proponent of Mako Madness, and he was just saying that, an opponent. He didn't like the tournaments, and his take was, I don't like applying a carnival atmosphere to, like, the killing of game, which was his perspective.
Yeah, but he wasn't a fisherman, right?
He was a fisherman.
He was. That's interesting.
Yeah. He actually served me some Mako shark.
Okay. Well, that's interesting then, because I feel like there's a deeper conversation to be had there, because I've always been kind of uncomfortable with, like, Bassmaster Classic and that kind of thing, because I think fishing is kind of a spiritual activity, at least to me. It's like where you go to find peace and calm and quiet and really, you know, work on your thoughts and your life philosophy and deal with things and be with friends and commune with nature and to see people putting a 200 horse outboard on the back of a 16 foot boat that's covered in glitter. And it, when I was a kid, I was eight, if you'd asked me, what are you going to do with your life? I would have said professional bass fisherman.
Yeah, but they're not hurting the they're not hurting the resource.
They're not hurting the resource, and it's all catch and release. I mean, the way they hold the bass by the lip and crank their neck, like, there's some new science out that's saying that's not the best handling practices. That's not my issue. But the carnival thing, like, I mean, that resonates on some level, that to put, like, an unnecessary, just competitive it seems so loud.
Yeah, there's a loudness to it. But I still oppose, like, I oppose the limits. I oppose the restrictions. Because I'm always looking at, when I think about something like this, I'm always looking at, like, what is the end game? What is the end game of the person pushing for it?
Yeah.
And I think I don't agree with their end game. And so
which is no more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I disagree with the unintended consequences perhaps more. Because, I mean, are they going to ban, like, the little cute trout derbies they do in Central Park?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who's that hurting?
You're not even, you can't promote it, so you can't even staple the sign to a tree anymore about it. Here's a question for someone. Dan Curtis, he's here tonight. His wife, Grace, they got a question. It was a long question. I'm trimming it down to a line. What is the level of etiquette that a hunter should expect upon gifting prime time meat to someone?
Prime time,
like high quality.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is high. Like, I expect, like when I give something, if I give someone the gift of fish and game, I have very, like, for them to please me, I need to see a high level of care, and I need to see prompt use. And that was one of the nicest things when I was living here. In Magnolia, I had my neighbor on that side, my neighbor on that side, and my neighbor across from me, and I gave them all a lot of fish and game, and they all cooked it real quick-like, and then would share with me, sometimes even with photographs, what they had done with it.
That's good practice.
And then I would the next day bring them more stuff. Like, yeah. I would constantly bring stuff over to these guys because I was seeing that return. If you give something and you find it in their freezer 6 months later, I've taken it back.
I was just up at my parents' house. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. And I want you to know that I've started to check your freezer. and I see that you still have some of my elk. And so I'm instituting a rule that I'm not giving any more until I find that it's depleted. You got it. And she sends me great photos of the... And she's an amazing... pastry chef and does really cool stuff with it and sends me Snapchats or whatever the whole process. And I love that. I think that's a great feedback loop that I'd encourage people to implement.
I scored a really good hunting permission one time where a guy let me on his place, his farm, and I just asked, can I hunt squirrels on your farm? No one else was hunting squirrels. And I got some squirrels and went home and made dinner with the squirrels and texted him a picture of what I made with his squirrels. He texted me back that I could hunt deer and elk on this place, or deer and turkeys on this place.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. He was so impressed.
Wow.
There you go.
Wow.
People like to see it.
Mm-hmm. That's all it takes. Yeah. How to score your next deer hunting permission right there, Stephen Rennell.
Text someone a picture of a dead squirrel, and he'll let you hunt his place.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I gave some meat recently to some folks, and I haven't heard back from them. But it got me thinking because I was going to ask him next time I run into him, you know, what'd you do? How was it? Whatever. Because recently I did that with some other folks that had given meat to maybe 6 months ago. And I was like, hey, what'd you do with the halibut? Some halibut that you'd given me. And I got the answer like, yeah, we ate it. I was like, you just ate it? That's all you got for me? And I just kind of, in my mind, I was like,
well, you
not
know
good
what?
Enough.
It's good that you you tell the story that way, because that better reflects what the question was. Because the question was about a gift, and there was no, you know, like, so how was it? There was no, you want the person to be like this.
But wait a second. So you re-gifted his halibut, though?
Yeah, I know. You didn't dig into that. So how do you feel
how do you feel about that?
On re-gifting your halibut?
Well, no.
Share the love.
You know I'm...
There you go. If I gave someone... Good reason. That's fine. I only care about the end. If I gave someone something and then they gave it to someone and that person came and was like this to me, that's great. It's just knowing that... Because in my mind, I'm doing people just a normal good turn, but I'm also doing like... I'm also trying to like publicly elevate the status of the resource.
Yeah.
So that... people will look at the water and look at the mountain or whatever, and they'll be like, oh, there's that thing, this giant, beautiful thing that produced this wonderful thing that I ate, and therefore I recognize the value of the producing habitat. I'm kind of getting at that, and I'm also kind of trying to be like a nice dude. But yeah, like bringing up, like elevating the resources, elevating the things that promote the resources. And so I don't give a shit who... in the end winds up having it. Another question, and this is like you and I talked, April, you and I talked about this one a long time ago, but this is an ethics conundrum where someone, and don't, what's that thing like, don't like killing the messenger, be mad.
I won't shoot the messenger, don't
worry. Shoot the messenger. I'm reading this, I'm paraphrasing a thing a dude is saying. How the pursuit of whitetails with a bow is one of the only times an inferior implement is considered morally superior. Using a spear would be further inferior and difficult, but there are very few advocating the moral purity of spear hunting. That's like a very legitimate point. It's like people feel great about using a bow but not a gun, but then if you use a spear, you lose all your sponsorships. Remember that dude that...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. Like,
the dude in the tree with the spear.
People didn't celebrate him.
Spear cam.
People didn't celebrate him.
They got blackballed.
No. It was immoral. Yeah. So it's like, rifle, this kind of moral. Bow, this kind of moral. Spear, it's confusing.
Where's that?
That's always confused me. I've never understood that.
Atlatl?
You can hunt with atlatls in some states.
In some states, you can hunt with atlatls.
But is that just, can you...
Lon, he's not done.
Okay.
Likewise, a person could choose to commute in a Model T or handsaw lumber for a home construction project. Making those choices would certainly make the tasks more arduous, but I doubt anyone considers the Model T commuter stuck in the Lincoln Tunnel to be morally superior to those in air-conditioned cars. Choosing a weapon which increases the perceived personal reward level for the hunter at the expense of a quick and humane kill is a dreadful, selfish act. His words. Let the hunt be challenging. Let the terrain be difficult. The game reclusive and wary. The location perilous to access. Add difficulty to the hunt in places where the quick dispatch of an animal doesn't hang in the balance. When it comes time to complete the most important task of hunting, choosing a weapon with the highest likelihood of an ethical and immediate kill is the highest moral ground.
So what's the question?
I like this guy.
The question is, you had expressed this to me before.
I had questioned you before.
You questioned about it. I'm just wondering where you're at on it, because that, like...
Yeah, like, no, that's good. I've got a lot to say.
Yeah, I put... I hold... Like, I struggle with how to... I know that I can tear his argument down. I just know that it's hard to do it.
Look.
I'm going to do it in a minute.
Do you want...
I'm going to try.
Go for it.
No, I want you to go first.
Well, I had asked Steve, when I had Steve on my show, I had asked Steve if it was more ethical to kill with a bow or a gun, because I hear conflicting reports. And I've only been hunting for, I don't know, 4 years. So for me, I was hearing all sorts of different reports. And a lot of people were telling me that a bow was more humane. And the more I looked into it, the more I was finding that it's actually kind of a gray area. So
no, it's not a gray area.
Well,
do you think that they, like, look at capital punishment. Do you feel that you could you imagine a situation where they administered capital punishment with archery equipment?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So only if they use those guillotine broadheads.
The guillotine, yeah.
The turkey.
It'd be like a big 9-inch cutting blade guillotine broadhead.
So since leaving you and looking more into it, like this year I went out with a gun. I was going to fully try to get one with a gun. I get stuck in limited situations when I've got my baby on my back, I'm obviously stuck with a bow. I'm not going to take a shot with her on my back with a gun. And some of the properties that I hunt, like in Australia especially, I can't have a gun. So I'm limited to the bow. Same with obviously different seasons. But if I can take an edit, for me, I want it to be the most ethical shot possible. I know we've had this conversation. You said the animal doesn't care. You know, it's going to die.
Yeah.
But I would like to get as close to the animal as possible so that I know I'm making the most accurate shot as possible. I don't care if it's a gun or a bow, but I need to know it's the most humane shot that I can make given my situation, whether I've got the baby or whether I've got property access.
When I think about the question, I think about why, like, I see what he's getting at. Is one thing I think about is I think that he's stripping this like really complicated thing down to a simple thing. He's like taking something that has many inputs and considerations and acting like the one consideration is how quickly one can administer death to this thing you're trying to hunt for. And it's like, I guess just to give a really honest answer about it is I have a lot of other factors that I'm considering in. And you also have like resource level things where the lack of efficacy if a bow is less effective than a gun, the lack of efficacy allows more people to participate in the activity. That's why in so many places you can get an overt. Everybody that wants can go archery hunting for something, but everybody that wants can't go rifle hunting for something. It's because the efficacy does it. So if we were really going to play the game to the end, it would probably be that you had to put out like a specific bait laced with a sleeping agent in a poison. If the only thing that hunters cared about was just like administering death as quickly as possible, you'd use grenade launchers.
Well, I think about this all the time.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like, if you're going to chase that, if that's going to be the only thing you care about and the only thing you chase, I don't know that we've really arrived at the right answer.
I don't think we have.
Because it's just more complicated. And I do think that, like, if you factor in that if you hit someone with a bow and you get a shot and you double lung it and it has enough time to go 20 yards and die, or it falls over and dies much more quickly, I think that hunting is like, there's a selfish act to it. You're like, you're doing a thing for a bunch of personal reasons. And the reward one gets for doing it in a way, like a difficult way, like a bow, and the amount of discipline and skill that it takes, it's a cold calculation. But maybe that reward that one feels outweighs that 3 seconds of...
Extra right, misery.
Like that gain for you and your calculus outweighs the 3 seconds of stress that the thing has as it crosses the stage and dies over there.
Maybe for some people, not for me. I would take any weapon that I feel I can get the job done with most efficiently, fastest. I started with a bow and it just kind of stuck from there. First gun I really shot was at your house.
Is that right?
Yeah. And I still shot that motherfucker in your backyard.
That's good. Kevin's
I want to know when bow hunting became like morally better.
Oh, dude, people act like it's way more.
Okay, you say people. You say people, but what people? Are they all
I'm not going to name names. I'm going to name names.
No, I know, but is there like a group or like can you break it down at all?
I feel like non-hunters are more likely to hold that perspective.
There was just a piece in the Wall Street Journal.
That's what I'm hearing. And Sam just hit it on the head. And same reason with why I started with the bow hunting is that everybody would be like, or people I'd meet be like, oh yeah, I hunt, but I'm a bow hunter. So as a non-hunter, someone looking to get into it, I kept hearing this, and I thought, well, that's just, I mean, it's the rednecks who shoot guns.
Yes.
And I heard someone just say fly fishermen, and that is, for me, it was a lot of that. A lot of these fly fishermen were getting into bow hunting, and they would say that there were parallels and that it was the equivalent to fly fishing. And they just made it sound like it was more ethical, and that's why I asked you, is it more ethical? Because these bow hunters were saying to me, yeah, you don't interrupt the environment, you know, with the sound, which is ridiculous because I was bow hunting all fall and I could hear guns everywhere. Like it didn't make a difference where I was. But the more I think about I don't know. I don't see how it is more ethical. Can you guys prove me?
It's wrong? Not. It's really
it's
not.
Like theoretically leveling the playing field somehow doing that's people that don't hunt that, or they're the like, oh, you're giving them, you know, oh, well I had to sneak up instead of just, you know, you got guys now 800 yards away and, you know, the whole people, you know, non-hunters, I live in Seattle, I'm surrounded by them. you know, there's lots of ways to pass judgment, but it's an easier way to gain some sort of, you know, legitimacy to it. Being it's like, well, it's hard.
But you know, I do like the stocking
like,
up.
Like, seriously, it's
the,
hard.
The stocking
it
up
is harder.
Is,
let's be straight. It's a lot harder for me to
but hard
worry about wind.
Hard isn't like, ethical. Hard is not ethical. It's two
exactly,
different things.
But you're asking the question as to why it's relevant.
Yeah, and it is a lot of non-hunters
I think
that,
this
that
is,
bring that forward. And I also think that, like, new hunters, too. Like, I've had a lot of my friends who have got into hunting in their late 20s, early 30s, and it's been fascinating to me to see the issues they have to wrestle with that have never, you know, never bothered me. Like, you know, I grew up like shoulder deep in salmon guts and, you know, bonking fish on the head and helping butcher deer and all that. So like the death part has never, I think I kind of walked over that threshold before I had quite the mental capacity to really wrestle with it. So it's always felt very natural, but people who are coming into it later really have to surpass some of these difficult questions, like how they feel about taking a life just for the sake of sport and sustaining their own life. And I think some people, I think a lot of people feel better about that if it feels more fair to them.
Yeah.
And what I always say is rifle hunting for elk is plenty fair. Like,
it's
I mean,
enough.
In Washington, it's going to be less than 10% of people who buy an elk tag.
No matter where you go, 10-20% success rate.
Yeah, absolutely. So
you,
I'm like,
if you want to be hard, only walk backward.
Yeah.
Like,
all right.
Only walk backward with a rifle is really challenging.
Yeah, or be a responsible rifle hunter like you guys do, like a rule you guys have that I've adopted of not taking shots past 400. Yeah. I mean, I haven't taken a shot past 300 in a long time.
It's just the closing the gap. That's all it was for me, was closing the gap. I still, if I have a gun in my hand, would rather get closer.
Sure.
Yeah.
I just, for me, it's all about closing the gap.
That's the fun part.
Okay, if you could snap your fingers and automatically be an absolute master of one hunting and fishing skill, what would the skill be?
Stalking.
Sneaking up on stuff.
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah, figuring out how to stay quiet, keep my heart rate under control, just like deep breath. See what I'm doing, get the wind right, not let the excitement of the moment, just taking that deep breath and figuring out, all right, the wind's this way, I need to go this way. Like because I have a good nose, I can, like once I'm in it, all of a sudden my whole game plan in every magazine or book or podcast or thing that I've read goes out the window. And it's like my heart rate's at like 140 and I'm like, and then you're trying to do everything correctly. Yeah, if I could just stay calm for a minute, that would be mine.
Are you hip to guys that have been using beta blockers to do that?
Well, define beta blockers. I've pretty much tried everything.
No, it's like, what the hell is a beta? It's like a medication. People take the medication for some reasons, then find that they don't get buck fever anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you're not like, there's, it's a banned substance. Like people that shoot competitive pistol shooting and stuff, they can't use beta blockers.
Okay.
Calms you down too much.
Maybe I should look into beta blockers.
Yeah, guys talk about no, dudes say that their doctor would put them on a beta blocker, and all of a sudden they realize that when a buck comes in, they don't get panicky. As panicky.
I don't get panicky. I just get, you know, in the moment, you're there. I just wish I was better. One skill. Quiet, and just quiet as a generality.
Mentally quiet.
Mentally quiet, and then also just to be able to read the circumstance.
I think if the one thing, like the thing that I missed out on is and was lazy about is all forms of calling. Because I always was, for whatever reason, would be with someone who was better at it than me and then let them be the one that did it.
Yeah. That went on and on and on.
And now here I'm in like my 40s. And I've always, like my early when I was a little kid, my brother Danny was a really good caller. So we hunted ducks, he just called. I just shut up because Danny was good at it. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, hunting elk with Giannis. Giannis is a great caller, so he just calls. Mm-hmm. And missing out on, like that, and it's never too late, but that I didn't cultivate that skill, and I'm only now just like a, you know.
Getting better at it.
Well, I kind of suck at it, but I mean, I make up for it in other ways a little bit. But yeah, that's been a real miss, man.
I like, I'm...
Sorry to interrupt, but the process is fun. I mean, I get this game, and I enjoy playing the game and just throwing out something that we could just like not have to learn and experience to get better. But like, if we're not sitting here saying that we don't enjoy like going through learning buck fever and how to, you know, get over it and learning calls for, I mean, yeah, we've been at it for 20 years now of like this freaking latex and glue in our mouths, just you know, just over and over and over. And but like, you got to enjoy that not being good and becoming good. I think that process, right?
Yeah, I think the journey seemed hard for me, you know? That's my regret.
You didn't enjoy it.
No, I didn't enjoy it. You got one?
Yeah, if I could and snap my fingers and become a master or something, I'd improve my archery shot. I've been doing an archery league at that little shop down the street from the office.
Yeah.
And God, I've been a mess. Like, because archery practice has always been a solitary thing for me. I'd like either shoot my backyard growing up or go out to the range in Missoula by myself. But shooting with, the last week they had like a steel barrel on a swivel that would like go around and both ends were cut off. And it would like, it wasn't like a slow spin. Oh my God, it threw me to...
What the hell is that supposed to teach you how to do?
Well, I don't know. Like, as like an elk passes through the gap.
Oh, like shooting fish in a barrel?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, having a bunch of people around and like, you know, coming into it cold. Like the first day I rolled up and I was already late. Everybody had started and I like pull out my bow and get ready. I'm like, oh, all broadheads, great. And one still has elk lung all over it. and so it's just, I could do so much to be a better bow shot. I've been doing it for 15 years and still feel like I have a long ways to go to reach the, you know, those, that 10,000 hours or reach mastery.
Yeah. One last thing I want to touch on, and then we're going to play our game.
I don't get to go.
Oh, you just did it, didn't you?
No. What was my thing that I was going to become better at?
The process of calling.
I was just enjoying the process.
You can go three times. I don't care. Go ahead.
He wants to master enjoying the process of learning things.
No, yeah, please. All you
want. If I could just snap my fingers and just like one thing I could just master in the whole hunting and fishing world, it would just be how to manifest and just conjure up animals. Like when I look at that hill and be like, there he is.
Always about the manifestations.
His dad knows how to manifest.
Yeah. No, in all seriousness, it'd be tracking.
Tracking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. To have that skill just to, like, without even, like, bending over from 6 foot to, well, my eyes are probably at 6 feet, just to look down and be able just to see you know,
which way,
way ahead, just follow, you know.
The best guy, the best people I know at it are people that were fur trappers.
Yes, I agree.
Because just like for hours every day, hours every day.
Yeah, you being one of those people.
And little teeny clues, man. Little teeny clues. Okay, we got to do our deal. Oh, how are we going to, you know what we didn't do?
Uh-oh.
Son of a.
I don't know what we didn't do.
Giving stuff away.
To do seeing through the bullshit.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Oh, but there's a thing I want to talk about real quick because so many people have written in about it. This is like this is one of those, you guys don't need to say anything, but we've had so many people write in about a border wall on our southern border. Like, what does a border wall mean for wildlife? And like, every day someone writes in about it because it's been in the news so much about whether we're going to build the border wall or not. But I find that people get mad, like, people don't want to hear the answer. They don't want to hear about it because they don't want it to challenge however they feel about it. Because there's a very legitimate argument to be made that you'd want to build a border wall, and you should be able to think that while knowing everything that would mean, right? Like, if you're talking with your spouse about whether you're going to go on vacation, and you decide, like, we're going to go on vacation, and then someone points out, well, if we go on vacation, we're going to have less money in our savings account. No one gets mad at you for pointing that out. So does the wall affect wildlife? Like, how could it? Like, absolutely it does. It cuts off. Like, people keep writing in about it like it's some kind of mystery. You're denying access to water to certain things, and you're preventing the movement of animals. And since the dawn of time, wildlife has moved freely back and forth across the border, and like jaguars come in and out, ocelots come in and out, desert bighorns, pronghorns, coos deer, mule deer, in some places even bison. And then historically you had species that would, like, for instance, they think that at the end of the Pleistocene, we lost mountain lions in what's now the lower 48, and mountain lions only lived to the south and then recolonized back and forth. So there's always been this exchange going on. And if you are saying you want to, if one's going to build an impenetrable wall, you're going to impede the exchange. But that's not like solving the question of whether it needs to happen in my mind, but it's just like a factor that one has to weigh. But like, people get pissed when you bring it up. I think you could bring it up and realize that that's the truth and still think that that's what you want to do, but it's just the reality.
I know guys who hunt that border country, who live down there, who are super worried about it. Think it's going to mess up their deer hunting.
Yeah. I know people who are worried about people coming across.
Yeah, I know those people too.
In that danger, and worried about the danger of wildlife. It's a messy issue. But people write in acting as though like there's like this sort of debatable answer, but I feel like it's like not debatable. It would have implications for wildlife. But now we're gonna play.
Do like doggy doors or something to?
Yeah,
that's what I keep wondering about, man. I haven't heard a guy making the case. Caller?
Yeah, a special code that only animals.
Yeah, you
know.
Figure out how to make a doggy door for desert mule deer and
code, a doggy door, a little thing. I've even heard people talk about the implications for low-flying birds and insects. But yeah, doggy doors.
Those guys I'm talking about are hardcore quail hunters who hunt like right down by the border. And I mean, I can't imagine quail couldn't figure it out. But they don't tend to fly super high, so might be problematic. I don't know.
How are we going to pick someone to play seeing through the bullshit?
I got it figured out.
Do it.
I'll combine it with our other thing that we're going to do.
Oh.
You like that?
I love it.
And I'm just going to go for the upper end of that.
Yep.
You got it? All right, so a couple things we're going to do tonight. Well, I'm just going to bring everybody down first. Okay, if it's your birthday today, not tomorrow, not yesterday, but today, come on down to the stage. Is there anybody in the house whose birthday is it today?
Oh, yeah.
What day is it? I see one. Sister's birthday.
Birthday?
Two. That's it?
We need the oldest person who's having a birthday.
Come on now.
But then you're disqualified. You're disqualified from the other thing you get for having a birthday.
Oh, I was just going to be super nice to them and,
well, we'll see.
And hook them up.
Zora, come down.
How many we got? Looks like, oh, I see more.
Is it?
More movement.
How old are you?
Does that change?
35.
Is anybody older than 35 today? Oh, there it is. They're coming down. They'll be about an hour and they'll be down here. Tell them the rules, Giannis.
For seeing through the bullshit?
Yep.
All right. We're going to play a game called Seeing Through the Bullshit. You might also know it as a... I've never played the drinking version of Two Lies and a Truth. Have you?
No.
Anybody here?
Good guy.
Oh.
Oh, how old are you?
30. 30.
No, he's 35.
35.
That's all right. That's all right. Hang out. That, we got more, though, right?
We got one coming down from the...
We got an old-timer coming from up high.
Okay.
So tell them the rules.
So whoever we choose to pick, we're going to tell you guys two lies and one truth. And then if you can guess which one is the true story...
Then you've seen through the bullshit.
You've seen through the bullshit.
Which is brought to you by Vortex.
You get to take home this brand new pair of Fury laser rangefinding binoculars that will laser rangefind reflective stuff at 5,000 yards. And deer at 1,000 plus. Steve was hitting some coos deer in January at like 1,100 with these suckers.
Lifetime warranty. How old are you?
26.
Wow. Boom.
How old are you?
54.
Oh, get out of here. No one's going to beat that.
No, he's not. All right.
Steve.
Coming up. I'm getting up.
Okay, cool.
Oh, you're giving up your spot?
I am.
Okay, so what happened to our person?
She's coming.
Coming? She's coming.
She's coming back. Coming up the stairs.
There it is.
Come on out.
What's your name?
I got a seat for you right here. Hi.
It's fun from here, isn't it? Nice to meet you.
Hey there. Take my seat, take my hand.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Happy birthday.
Hello. So, what's your name?
Clary.
Clary? Okay. Clary, we're going to tell you...
Closest
I'm gonna sit
kisser.
Just so she knows, I'm going to sit close to her so that possibly they can pick up her voice on my microphone. Are you comfortable with that?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Where are you
from?
Not,
you're not American.
England.
England, okay.
Welcome.
All these stories are distinctly American. How long have you been here?
16 years.
Oh, okay, you're good. Oh, you're okay, up to speed. Great. All right.
Did you hear the rules for the game?
No.
Oh, okay, you were busy walking down.
I'm busy running down.
So we're going to tell you, who's telling them? Sam? April?
I'm going to tell a story. April's going to tell a story.
No, Sam.
I'm going to tell a story. Sam's going to tell a story. Giannis is going to tell a story. One of them is true. Okay. You just need to identify the true one. We'll start with Giannis.
Okay. Everybody knows that you can take goats and put them in a pen.
Goats, yes.
Mm-hmm. And force them to eat knapweed and other types of weeds. And then you can let them, they'll sort of become accustomed to it, and that'll become their diet. When you cut them loose out in the wild, they'll eat the weeds, and they don't eat the native. And that's a way that we, here in the States, we get rid of weeds out on, you know, wide open pastures in the forest.
So are you tracking that?
That sounds very clever. Yeah.
Okay.
It is.
Well, it gets better.
So there's a problem here in Washington where there's a pod of orcas. You may have heard of the southern pod. Is that
southern resident?
Southern resident pod that only eat Chinook salmon, right? Have you heard about this?
No.
Oh, well.
One minute. You people... Just
you guys are gonna be allowed to help later. We're gonna let you help later, but let us get through the stories before you start.
You all.
I wouldn't trust them quite yet because they have no idea.
You mean you men and women?
Yes.
And everything in between.
Yes.
Hunters and huntresses.
You all.
Thank you.
Hunters, huntresses.
Make it go away. God.
Okay. So.
Even you irrational ones out there. Okay, so there's the state of Washington, they got a problem with these orcas because there's not enough salmon for them to eat. So they're getting skinny and they're not doing well. So there's another pod of orcas out that go up and down the coast that eat mammals like sea lions, seals, and whatnot. Yes. So what they're thinking about doing is making a net and capturing a few of these southern pod orcas and actually taking seals that they've caught and like cutting off a fin or a chunk of the tail and putting it in the net with these orcas to sort of start getting the orcas to feed on these the seals to then turn them into predators that work off of seals and not be just, you know, so... That's the word I'm looking for.
Reliant
on the salmon. Okay. They're just looking into that.
Okay.
That's mine.
Now, you're familiar with the state of Wyoming. Okay, there's a big reservoir called Flaming Gorge in Wyoming. A dude is there fishing, and he cuts his thumb off on his boat prop in July. Okay? That winter, a feller is fishing through the ice and catches a lake trout, opens its gut up, and finds a thumb in its gut. They connect the feller that lost his thumb with the feller that found the thumb. The guy comes and has a look, and he says, "I think that's my thumb." And he now keeps the thumb in a jar of formaldehyde on his mantelpiece.
That's possible.
Okay.
Sam?
So are you familiar with Catalina Island off of Southern California?
Yes, I know where it is.
So for a very long time, they've had problems with feral goats eating... big problems. They can't get rid of them. It's a big island, very rugged terrain. They've tried all sorts of different solutions for getting rid of them. Back in the 70s, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed planting coyotes on the island, which would naturally kind of take care of the goats. But obviously they're worried about creating a new invasive species. So what they proposed to do was plant a subcutaneous cyanide pill inside the coyote's digestive tract that would break down over the years, so after they'd done their jobs, they would expire.
Coyotes with cyanide? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, because somebody else would then eat them, and then they die.
You may be unfamiliar with the goofy stuff wild game managers have done in this country.
We're talking about the 70s. That's when animals were harmed in the making of movies.
All right,
that's so when they were capturing...
The man that got his thumb back from the belly of a lake trout or the orca project that they're going to start feeding them new cut-up seals to get them to turn them into better predators or the cyanide pill-filled coyotes.
I'm going with the thumb.
You got it.
Yeah.
All right. But here's the thing. Someone in Australia is looking at how to do a time capsule death dingo.
That's where we got it from.
Yeah,
it won't happen, It won't happen.
I guess Australia's bigger than Catalina, right?
Yeah. Like, what are you going to do with those?
What is it?
You win a prize.
A really nice prize.
It's a pair of binoculars that have a laser rangefinder built into them.
Oh,
did you?
I was just going to ask, are you sure you came to the right show tonight?
Like, I've been looking at my ticket thinking, when are they going to start singing? You
know? That's coming next.
You're like, where's the part where they're like, don't cry for me, Argentina?
Oh.
This is for my husband.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you,
everybody.
Appreciate it.